We are privileged to be able to have the influence of the Markham Missionary Church felt around the world. We have a number of missionary representatives that we are assisting in their support in different parts of the world. And some are still at home but haven't been idle as they are looking forward to serving the Lord in a cross-cultural situation in overseas. And family that we have with us is in that category. Winston gave me the task of introducing John and Wendy, to introduce two people who don't need any introduction to this congregation. I wasn't here when they were first here. As you know, Wendy is a daughter of one of our former deacons, Al Stewart. John comes from Windsor. And I'm not sure, I didn't check with you. How long have you been with Campus Crusade? Seventh year. And so they haven't been inactive in the Lord's work, nor inactive in cross-cultural work. Because if I know anything about Campus Crusade, on the campuses, they are reaching out to those who have, of the mission field, that have come to our very door. But John and Wendy have felt the call of God upon them to go overseas. And we were pretty concerned for a while, John, during this past year, as we heard of your medical problems, and we just wondered, but we prayed. And we're just so glad to know that the Lord has answered. You may tell us more about that a little later on this evening. John and Wendy, we are so glad to have you here this evening to share with us what God has been doing and what God is, what you believe God is going to do in and through you in the days ahead. So John and Wendy, would you come forward, please? Let's welcome John and Wendy and their son tonight.
We have two very different little boys. Our 18-month-old stands at the nursery and says, "Goodbye, get out of here, pick me up whenever." And the other one has been in one too many church nurseries, so he may end up joining us up front. We just aren't too sure what will happen down here in the front row. It's sure good to be home.
If he joins us up front, maybe it's a sign of a budding pastor or something. Well, it's great to be back in Canada. One of the first things that strikes me when I got off the plane in Detroit and we were driving down the freeways, everything's so green and lush. Because really, where we came from in California, it was very much a desert-type climate. And it's great to be back here to see everyone. It's been 2 years since we've been back here in the summer. So we've become real Californians. And if you pick up any accent, forgive us. We'll get the A's back. As most of you know, Wendy and I have been on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ. And it's been a pleasure to serve with Campus Crusade. The first 3 years, we were at the University of Western Ontario working with university students. And then the past 3 years, we've been in California. California is a tough mission field. We've had to put up with earthquakes and riots and all sorts of calamities. But we survived. And while we were in California, we were there to receive further theological training in preparation to go overseas. And we were also there working with international students. And just to give you an update of some of the things that were happening with our international ministry there, when we first arrived, there was no specific ministry to international students at California State San Bernardino campus. And so we were working with internationals there and at the University of California, Riverside. But the ministry at Cal State San Bernardino really took off. And now, after 3 years of working with it, it became the largest ministry to international students in the United States. So we really appreciate the involvement that you've had in our lives, because you've had a major impact on all of these international students from different countries who have come to study in the United States, and seeing them get involved in Bible studies, evangelistic Bible studies, where they get to know more about Christ, and then others who become Christians or who are Christians, they would get in follow-up Bible studies and further discipleship Bible studies, so they would grow in their faith. One of the students that stands out in particular to me his song. And he didn't actually become a Christian through our ministry, but he became a Christian as a result of a pastor who was retired but still had a heart for ministry. And I think most pastors have hearts for ministry even after they're retired. But in particular, this pastor, he was a Korean pastor living in the L.A. area. And he put an ad in the newspaper, you know, have you just come from Korea? You know, are you feeling lonely? Give me a call. And this student had come from Korea, and he really, you know, was experiencing culture shock. He was experiencing loneliness. And so he called the number, and he was not from a Christian background. So he met with the pastor, and the pastor really spent time with him, helped meet his needs transitioning to the new culture, but also shared the message of Jesus Christ with him, and he ended up coming to know Christ. Well, I met him on the campus last September, and it was just, we hit it off right away, and we continued meeting through the rest of the school year, meeting once a week for Bible study, and then we'd have them over for dinner and things. And I just appreciated so much how, from our initial meetings, where he was at in his faith to where he's at now. Because when I first met him, he had a lot of questions, and he wasn't really sure. You know, he had accepted Christ, but he really wasn't sure what it meant. And then his aunt died, and his aunt was a Christian. And so he was asking questions, why would God let this happen? My aunt, you know, was only 35 and she died of a cancer and she left a little baby behind. Why would God do this? And after coming through all those hard experiences, Song would go on to share Christ with his family when they would come home for his aunt's funeral. And then he would take further steps to want to share Christ with other students on campus. So that's just one incident of how God has been working in some of the students' lives there.
It's been fun for me, team ministering with John. I'm at home during the day with the boys, but a lot of our ministry is out of the home, because what you have is these students are here from other countries. Most are working on their PhDs, so they're older. And after they've been in the United States for 2 or 3 years, they've made enough money to fly their wife and children over. And their wife and children come and can't speak a word of English. And not to be stereotyped at all here, the male of the family can speak great English and can't remember at all having any culture shock or why his wife is crying and wanting to go home or any of that. And so we found it's really neat for me to be able to have a ministry out of the home, because John's built a relationship with these guys. And then when their wife arrives, we'll go by the first night with flowers or something and just say, welcome to the United States. And they see us as also being in a foreign country and having gone through culture shock, because they look at us as obviously from a different country, from Canada. And then to build a relationship, to have them over in our home, and the kids play with Jonathan and Joshua, and I get to know the wife, and at first, of course, she can't speak much English, but eventually we can build a real friendship and then share the gospel through that. I was encouraged. We've been staying with my aunt in Ajax last week, and she had a missions meeting and was inviting the missions committee over one night that we were there, and we just happened to be there the same night. So I was setting the table for her, and Jonathan, he just turned 3, and he got all excited. Oh, the students are coming, the students are coming. And I've seen our ministry be able to have an effect on the children, because they've been actively involved too. And I really noticed it when the people started walking in the door and he started greeting them in Chinese. Now, you have to understand, from a 3-year-old's perspective, when they have 5 or 6 other 3-year-olds and 2-year-olds and 4-year-olds running around them speaking in Chinese, it doesn't sound Chinese to them. And so Jonathan just answers them the same way that he thinks that they're talking. From their perspective, they don't understand English anyways, so they don't know that he's answering them in Chinese. And so as the people would come in, they would say, oh, hello, what's your name? And he'd say, oh, Cha Ching. And then someone else would come in, and he would be Chang. And someone, he was just, and I thought, yes, our ministry is definitely having an effect on our children. But it has been fun. Actually, it was really neat the other day, just before we came home, about a week before we came home, we had someone in our home who we've just had to go really slow with in sharing the love of Jesus Christ. A lot of experience and very little verbal, just because of who this man is. And Jonathan came running out of the playroom because he had found something he had lost that he'd been praying for. And that opened the whole door because this man, Dennis, said, oh, have you taught him to pray for things he's lost? And we said, no, but we've taught him to go to God whenever he has something he wants to say to him, whether it's something he needs or just something he wants to say. And that opened the whole door to talk with this guy. And so that's been the exciting part for me, because it's allowed me to be actively involved in ministry, but at the same time to be able to be at home with my kids. We had 4 major outreaches with the international students at Cal State: fall, Christmas, winter, and barbecue. And they ranged from barbecue in the beginning of the summer. They ranged from 60 to 120 students coming out. And it's just been really, it's been fun for us. We've really enjoyed it. We can really say that we've enjoyed our time there. And of course, you have had a profound impact on a lot of people's lives just through your prayer support and your financial support, allowing us to do this in California.
And I would say, one thing I found about international students, they just have so many needs coming to this new country. They've left their families behind. And if you have the opportunity to have one of them come over to your house regularly and to spend time with them, they will give you back so much love in return, because you know they're just waiting for someone, a North American, to let them get to know what North Americans are like, and to let them see inside of a North American home, and to see what life is like here.
They're also very open to going to church, because they want a full North American experience. And so one of the first things we ask on you know, a survey that we'll hand out or when we meet someone is, are you interested in coming to church with us one Sunday? And we have not yet had any international students say no, that they aren't. So that's been kind of neat.
Changing topics, another part of our preparation for going overseas was attending this Agape International training in Bakersfield last summer. And God has put us through some interesting circumstances with that Agape International training. The purpose of the training was in the morning, the purpose was preparation for going overseas. And Campus Crusade puts all of their missionaries through it, and a number of other missions organizations also use it because the training's so intense and it's done with such high quality. But generally, in the mornings, we would be involved in hearing classroom theory on ministering cross-culturally. Then in the afternoons, we would go out and minister cross-culturally. Well, in California, the cross-cultural ministry assignment was the inner-city black community. And it is very much a different culture from our culture and from the other students who are going through this missionary training. Well, we learn to appreciate the people in that community very much. They were open. You could just knock on their door and they would invite you into their home, and you could, you know, start talking about the Lord with them. It was no problem. They were just so open, and it was almost refreshing to them to see white faces in this primarily ghetto community, and that's where they had us live during this time. So we saw some tremendous things happen, and I think it was a great thing. But some things happened along the way. For example, we had a drive-by shooting on our front lawn, and so we had to move. And
we moved 7 times in 11 weeks.
and so it was, you know, I think of all the places overseas I could go, there might be a few that would be more dangerous than living in the ghetto in Bakersfield, but maybe the ghetto in Los Angeles would be more dangerous. But we survived, and I think it was good because we had to trust the Lord through it. But also during that time, part of this missionary training, we went down to Mexico to practice language learning skills. And it was fine. Wendy's mom and dad were down there with us at that time helping watch the kids. And they stayed at the Radisson, and we were at the Hotel San Antoinette or whatever. And tell them what your dad said about your mom.
Oh, it's funny. My dad is so funny. He came to the hotel where we were staying, and we wanted them at a different hotel with the kids because the water in our hotel wasn't purified, and the toilet was right sort of next to the bed, and Joshua was at the age where his favorite game is let's put our whole head in the toilet, literally. So anyways, we wanted him in a different spot just because I couldn't be there the whole time, and we just didn't feel that it was safe enough. So my dad comes in, and our bed sheets on the bed were probably about 15 years old, and they were so thin that with the two sheets, you could still see the faded pattern from the mattress through it. And so what's so funny now is he'll tell my brothers and sisters this, and he'll go, when your mom saw the hotel room, it broke her spirit. It just broke her spirit. It's so funny because nothing fizzes her, you know, but it was just funny. So everyone teases him that we were down doing evangelism in the marketplace of Mexico, and he was throwing tracks off the balcony at the Radisson Hotel. So you'll have to tease him when he comes up here.
Yeah, he's a real missionary. We had a hard time talking to them. They wanted to stay on the San Diego side with the kids. They didn't even want to stay in Tijuana, but we talked them into it.
I will say, though, there was not one hungry Mexican child within 2 miles of us by the time we left. He bought every banana in the marketplace, and every child had food in their hands that we passed, that's for sure.
But while we were down there for this language acquisition skills practicum, I picked up something, and when we were back in Bakersfield, I was really sick for 10 days, had fever, shakes, and was running to the bathroom all the time. And but then afterwards, things cleared up somewhat, but my system never returned to normal, and so we kind of went from one specialist to another, and after $6,000 or $7,000 worth of medical expenses, we had insurance while we were down there. But they finally figured out, or finally, I went to a tropical disease specialist at Loma Linda University, which is a Seventh-day Adventist hospital. And the Seventh-day Adventist church has missionaries all around the world. They were there, you know, there were Seventh-day Adventist medical missionaries in Brazil when we were there, and in Guyana, and I'm sure they're all over. And so they see a lot of missionaries at Loma Linda. So I hooked up with this doctor, and right away, the other doctors were saying, well, I don't know what you have. I guess you have two options. We can start repeating the test, which costs $7,000 or whatever, or we can, you know, you can get a second opinion. So I went to this tropical disease specialist, and right away, she knew a number of options that it could be, and it ended up, she said, you had a serious infection, intestinal infection, that you probably picked up in Mexico, and that's gone now. There's no sign of it in your system. It's gone. However, she said, one of the things that we've seen in working with missionaries is that a number of times when a missionary has a serious intestinal infection, or after they've had a number of them, it can take up to 2 years before the bowel actually recovers and returns to normal. And one of the things they noticed when they're doing some of my tests is the lining to my bowel was burned or it was gone. And so I guess basically because milk products are one of the most difficult things to digest, by going off milk products, my weight loss is stabilized. I'm not experiencing the flu-like symptoms 24 hours a day. And I feel a lot better. And so I appreciate your prayers and your support through that time, because it was really almost 6 months that we didn't know what was happening, and they were testing for AIDS, and they were thinking of cancer, and they were thinking all these different things, not really knowing what was happening. And it ended up being a simple solution, so to speak, or something that's controllable.
And it makes me think, too, of the Bible verse about when you go through something, this is definitely paraphrased, when you go through something, it's so you can sympathize with others. And Pam Kennedy wrote us a letter and told us about the hard time she'd gone through and that she had a red meat allergy. And that's one of the things as well that alerted us to maybe this could be a food allergy. And so that was just kind of neat.
Well, so the plans are on again for Nigeria. They weren't really off. They were just kind of on hold. And so we're heading we're planning to leave for Nigeria in January. And to give you some background to what we'll be doing in Nigeria, the missionary church, one of their major mission fields around the world is in Nigeria. They've been there they started early in this century working in Nigeria. And there's a theological college there called the United Missionary Theological College, which is located kind of in a central area of Brazil, of Nigeria. And I visited there 2 years ago, and it's a great school. They're getting more and more students every year. And one of the things that's happening in the African situation, or that's typical of the African situation, also typical of Nigeria, is the church is expanding very rapidly, so rapidly that it's hard to get trained pastors to lead the new churches that are being planted. And so less than 50% of the pastors who are in charge of these churches have had any formal theological education. So the Missionary Church of Nigeria is really trying to help solve that problem. And it was great to see all of the young men and women, and also older men and women, who have taken time out to study at the college, to study the Bible more in depth, to learn basic Bible study methods, and to be trained for a lifelong ministry to the different Christians or different people who have become Christians there. So, at the time I was there, there were 5 faculty and about 250 students. Now I anticipate there's probably 300 students and about the same number of faculty. So there's a dire shortage of faculty teaching at the school, and they would like our help in that area. And also they would like our help in training these pastors and these future missionaries who are going to be going out to other parts of Nigeria, training them in evangelism and discipleship. And that's one of the strengths that Wendy and I picked up since we've been working with Campus Crusade the last 6 years.
As far as my role in Nigeria, our kids will be staying with us on the mission compound, and so a majority of my time will be taken up with them. But I would also be supporting John in what he does, and that would involve with the men that are going through the school having their wives and families into our homes, and also taking some of the female students out, teaching them to do evangelism. And down the line, once the kids are, they will be with us, they won't be going down to the missionary school, but if they attend a Nigerian school there or whatever, that would free me up also to possibly teach a course to some of the women going through the school. This is a letter from Dr. Tim Gousset, who is the Director of Affairs for West Africa with Campus Crusade for Christ. And he says that in part of his letter to us, "Praise be to God that your medical problem has been diagnosed. I was beginning to wonder why it seems so difficult to fill the vital spot on the UMTC faculty. First it was Kellum. He developed a tumor on his brainstem that, though successfully removed, never healed well enough for him to be permitted to serve outside North America. When I heard of your medical situation, my response was, oh no, Lord, not again." Now Kellum was... he still is on staff of Campus Crusade for Christ. And as he was leaving for Nigeria, he had some medical problems, and they found this cancerous tumor in his brainstem. Removed it, but it left some nerve damage to his eyes. And because of the climate in Nigeria, he can't be there. It's interesting because I talked with Jim McDowell 2 nights ago, and he said that when he had heard of John's health problems, he said, oh no, Lord, not again. And he actually said to me that they had talked about it sort of as a group. I don't know who all the group was, but had come to the conclusion that if John's medical problems were serious enough that he couldn't come to Nigeria, they were not going to pray for a third person, because obviously the Lord didn't want this position filled. But instead, diet is easy enough to control. It's so much better than anything else that it could have been that they were testing for. We see it that Satan is working really hard to prevent us from going. It is a strategic position there. And it's not, we don't feel that we are the only ones that can fill that position, but we're willing to go and fill it. And we're not dying to get to Nigeria. John's dad keeps saying to us, here's a lot, I'll build you a house. And there's a nice park right next to it and a walking trail. And I keep saying, don't tempt me, don't tempt me. What we're called to do is be obedient. We know that it's going to be hard, but we are firm that this is where the Lord is calling us to go, and we are going to be safest in the center of His will. And this summer for me is really hard, because to me it's a lot of goodbyes. When we move back in December, we have $20,000 to raise for flights over, setting up costs, evacuation flights, stuff like that. If that's raised, we will be leaving in January. so it won't be a time for goodbyes. We'll be so busy packing and we will say our goodbyes, but now's our time for good visits. And that's hard for me because I'm realizing that, I'm going to cry here. I'm choosing. I'm choosing that my children won't have the same relationship with their grandparents and their aunts and uncles, my brothers and sisters and John's sisters, that the other kids will. And we both come from wonderful families, and I realize they aren't going to have those same relationships. They might not run into Grandma and Grandpa's arms because they might not recognize Grandma and Grandpa. And that those relationships will be good, but they'll be different. And that I can't have any control over them. It's going to be up to the aunts and uncles and grandparents back home to write letters, to send videos. I can't control that. And so I'm willfully choosing to take my children away from a blessing that is such a tremendous blessing. And yet, so for me, it's not easy just to say, let's go. And I know that there are going to be hard times in Nigeria, and I know that there are a lot of things we won't be able to do or won't be able to have. But we are called to be obedient, and I see Satan working very hard to keep us from doing that. And I pray, or ask you to pray, you know, that we would stay obedient, that we would keep our eyes focused on what Christ wants us to do. Because although we're called to be obedient, we're also called to use wisdom. And John's going to share with you some news that we've gotten from Nigeria that kind of needs our wisdom in it, too.
Yeah, this is a... This is a newspaper dated May 21st, 1992, the Orange County Register. And it reads, Lagos, Nigeria. The military government banned all associations based on tribal, ethnic, and religious ties Wednesday after 3 days of rioting between Christians and Muslims that left more than 200 people dead. And then it goes on to describe more of the unrest, but I've tried to get through to find out more about what's happening. Communications between North America and Nigeria are very poor. I tried 2 weeks to get a hold of the director in Nigeria a couple weeks or before we came from California, and I got through once, and I was basically able to get out my name and a few other details, and then the phone went dead. And so you're so frustrated because you try to get through and nothing's really happening. And however, we will be seeing the director of West Africa. He'll be in Canada during the middle of July, and we'll be talking with him, finding out more about the situation there. But you can be praying, because this year Nigeria is transitioning from military dictatorship to a democracy, and you have... 50% of the population is Muslims and they live in the north, and the other 50% is basically Christians and they live in the south, and they kind of meet in the middle, and we're kind of in the middle where we'll be. And so I don't know what the situation is going to be like. You can pray for peace for the country. I know the people don't want to see unrest. I know they want to see a stable government, and they want to see their country to get on its feet and for their economy to get going. But the way it sounds, there's a lot of trouble there. And you can just pray for wisdom. Because after hearing more about some of this unrest, I'm thinking, okay, we anticipate January as the date for departure, but that's very much in the Lord's hands what happens. That's what we're aiming for, and that's what we're planning. I'll know more next month, and I will bring you up to date as soon as I find out more on that. In light of those difficult prospects for Nigeria, I was there 2 years ago, so I kind of got the feel for what it would be like to live in Nigeria. And there are definitely going to be a lot of sacrifices we're going to have to make. On the one hand, I'm looking forward to what God can do, because God is a great God and He can do mighty things. And if Wendy and I are obedient and are willing to serve Him, I know He can work through us and do a tremendous thing there in Nigeria to help them out. But on the other hand, I'm not looking forward to going because I know there are going to be troubles, there are going to be different trials that we'll face, and that we're going to have to sacrifice personal safety at times, we're going to have to sacrifice our health, and definitely we're going to have to sacrifice comfort, you know, 100% humidity for quite a substantial part of the year. So I think in that sense, I have a realistic view of what it will be like in Nigeria. But it will involve sacrifices. I think when I was thinking of some of the sacrifices that we would have to make, because just in light of this article and that, it's been on my mind more, the story of what happened to one of my friends who was in Kenya came to my mind. This friend was working with the Maasai Indians in Kenya. And the Maasai tribe, different missionaries had tried to reach out to this tribe, and they didn't see any results. And then in the early 1980s, when the Jesus film, after it had been, published, they started translating it into different languages. And one of the languages, first languages they translated into, was a Maasai tribal language. So our friend had the opportunity to lead a team to go into among this tribal group and to show the Jesus film to these people. Well, this is the first film these people have ever seen. So they, you know, this tribe is quite primitive. They're nomadic. They live in huts made of cow dung, and they get along. But when they set up the screen and the projector and generator and they start showing the film, it was evident that they didn't completely understand what was happening. So they had to go through the film very slowly and explain, well, yes, in this scene, Jesus is a baby, and in this scene, he's a 12-year-old, and in this scene, he's an adult, but you know, there's a number of years in between here that aren't on the film. And so they would go through explaining how films work and then explaining more, you know, who Jesus is and what this film is about. So after two nights, it took them two nights to show the film. They worked through the end of the film the second night. And the chief of the tribe comes up to them and says, and basically, yes, I want to put my trust in Christ. And with the chief indicating that decision, basically the rest of the tribe would follow suit. And so it was an amazing thing because, you know, other missionaries had laid the groundwork. Other missionaries had been sowing seeds. But they came in with a film, and at that time, the people understood and they wanted to put their trust in Christ. Then afterwards, the chief, being so thankful for what our friend had done and what this missionary team had done, he wanted to offer them a show of his appreciation. So he brings out this big glass, this cup. And in this cup is a mixture of sour goat's milk, blood, and urine. But it's the way for him to show his highest honor to this individual, and so he offers it to our friend. Think, would you accept the chief's offer? Well, our friend did. He made a personal sacrifice, drinking that cup in order not to offend the chief and not to cause any stumbling block or to cause any problem, any future problem with the spiritual growth of the tribe. Needless to say, he was sick and he spent some time in the hospital afterwards. But that was one of the sacrifices God called him to make. And I think it was proper for him to do that. I think a similar type of sacrifice is what Paul is calling the people to make in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10. Because in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10, Paul's addressing the problem in the Corinthian church where some people had realized that idols were really just man-made things. There was no God behind them, so any meat sacrificed to these idols was completely all right to eat it. And Paul agreed that the idols were nothing, and really the meat sacrificed to nothing would be okay. However, these stronger brothers who understood that idols were nothing were actually going to put some weaker brethren in danger, because these weaker believers intimately connected the sacrifice of meat with idol worship. And so even though these stronger Christians had every right in the world to go on and eat this meat, he called them to sacrifice their personal freedom for the benefit of these other believers. And I think then Paul goes on laying down this basic principle that we as believers need to lay down those personal rights if we're going to be a stumbling block to other people. Then in chapter 9, Paul lists his life example. His life was characterized by making sacrifices for other people. He refused to get married or chose not to get married, whereas the other apostles got married in order that he could be more effective in ministry. And I think a guy who got thrown in jail and left for dead and beaten and all those things, it was better for him not to be married. And then also Paul refused to take any monetary benefit from the churches he was working with. And again, I think it was a case of personal integrity that no one would question that he was a charlatan, that he was just there to get money. And so he made that sacrifice, even though he says he had every right to receive a living from preaching the gospel, yet he didn't take people up on that right. And then in verses 24 to 27, the scripture passage that was read, Paul's coming to conclude his argument, and he uses this illustration from athletics. He uses this illustration of how when an athlete runs and competes, he competes to win. But in order to win, what does the athlete have to do? The athlete makes tremendous sacrifices and undergoes tremendous self-discipline so that he can bring home the prize. And so Paul appeals to this illustration to bring home the point that the Corinthians and we as believers need to live lives of radical self-discipline, lives where we're going to sacrifice on behalf of others. I think this illustration from athletics was quite appropriate for Paul to make. Just outside of Corinth was the home of the Isthmian Games, and these games were second in importance only to the Olympics, and they were conducted every 2 years. Paul was probably at one of these games in AD 51, so he would have been familiar with what took place. And the Corinthians, it was a highlight. Every 2 years, the games took place, so they knew what was going on. And Paul writes to them, he says, "Run in such a way that you will win." And he knew, he goes on to say, you know, how is someone to run to win? And in verse 25, he says, "And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things," or the NIV states, goes into strict training. And the word there, I think the NIV has translated the idea there properly, because at the time of Paul, for someone to be eligible just to compete in the games that took place, they had to undergo 10 months of supervised training. They had to stick to rigid diets and to sacrifice their personal freedoms in order to be prepared to run their hardest when they would compete in these challenges and in these different events. I think today what hits home, something that I have struggled with earlier in my life and what I see as being so prevalent in North America, is this whole idea or this whole tendency of people today to sacrifice their health, and not only their health, but marriages, relationships with family, relationships with other loved ones, even best friends, in order to move up the ladder higher, or in order to receive a greater financial gain. And Paul makes a point here, because he really lays down that the motivation for believers to make sacrifices to complete the call that God has in their life is not for something which is only relevant for this lifetime, but something which isn't eternally relevant. And he says in the second part of verse 25, "They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we imperishable." or they do it to receive, as the NIV states, it doesn't say imperishable, but they do it to receive a perishable crown, but we do it to receive an imperishable crown. And back in those days, I think it would even strike home really well to the Corinthians, because this individual, after running the 185 meters or whatever they would run in the running race competition, he would be declared the winner. He spent all of this time in preparation, and yet at the end of the race, the crown that was placed on his head was probably celery, and in the heat of that climate, it would be withered. At the most, some others have suggested it was pine boughs. But when you think, here, the person has put so much effort forth and has made so many sacrifices, but for this thing that's temporally significant, insignificant in comparison with the crowns and the rewards that we will have when Christ returns, which lasts forever. I think as I've been going through this preparation for Nigeria, I think God's been really bringing this issue to heart with me. He's been saying, John, it's going to be tough. You've been there. You know what it's going to be like to live there. You know that there will probably be another coup while you're there, and you're responsible for your family. It's not going to be easy. And yet, I think this passage has helped me to realize that, yes, times are going to be difficult, but God calls each and every one of us as Christians. He calls the Corinthians to sacrifice personal rights for the benefits of others. And he calls each and every one of us to do the same. That our lives should be characterized by this radical, self-sacrificial behavior. I think of this church as another example, and I know that this building stands here today as a result of different individuals in this church living lives of radical self-discipline, of giving, so that this could come, so that this building could come to existence. Lastly, Paul, in giving the motivation, he holds up this idea that we have these eternal rewards, and that should motivate us to live lives of radical self-discipline. But then also he reminds us that there's the possibility that we could lose these rewards, that we could be disqualified and forfeit the prize. And I think, too, that that also should motivate us. And you know, you read the newspaper every day and how different men are falling, it seems, rather than continuing to walk with the Lord and living lives of self-sacrifice. Instead, they turn to indulgence and forfeit their rewards. So in conclusion, I think I would like to ask you to pray for Wendy and I. Pray that we would be willing to follow God, to fulfill his calling in our lives, even though that's going to mean we'll have to make some sacrifices, we'll be facing tough situations. And I'll be praying for you, because I know that God has even greater things prepared for this church here in Markham. And I know that we've made one sacrifice to put up this building, but there's so many other sacrifices along the way that he's calling us to make, so that this church can accomplish the ministry and accomplish the calling that God has prepared for it. So I will pray for you, and I ask that you pray for me.